The sallow souk doctor was totally absorbed in himself and his technical research on the orbiting laboratory moon of Corona. He showed not the slightest respect or fear when the Baron's name was mentioned. "I may work for the Richesians," he said in a firm, humorless voice, "but I do not belong to them." Peter DeVries, sent to Richese to work out the confidential details for the Baron, studied the doctor's aged wooden features, the oblivious stubbornness. They stood together in a small laboratory office on the artificial research station, a grand satellite that shone in the Richesian sky. Despite the emphatic request of Premier Calamar, narrow-faced Yue, with long drooping mustaches and a rope of black hair gathered into a silver souk ring, declined to go to Gedi Prime. Self-confident arrogance, DeVries thought. That can be used against him. "You, sir, are a mentat, accustomed to selling your thoughts and intelligence to any patron." Yue drew his lips together and studied DeVries as if he were performing an autopsy. Or wanted to. "I, on the other hand, am a member of the Souk Inner Circle, graduate of full Imperial conditioning." He tapped the diamond tattoo on his wrinkled forehead. "I cannot be bought, sold, or rented out. You have no hold over me. Now please allow me to return to my important work." He gave a minimal bow before taking his leave to continue research in the Richesian laboratories. "That man has never been put in his place, never been hurt, never been broken." Peter DeVries considered it a challenge. In the governmental buildings of Triad Center, Richesian Premier Calamar's apologies and posturing meant nothing to DeVries. However, he could easily make use of the man's authorization to pass through the security gates and guards, to return to the Corona Satellite Research Station. With no choice in the matter, the mentat went to Dr. Yue's sterile medical laboratory. Alone this time. Time to renegotiate for the Baron. He did not dare return to Gedi Prime without a fully cooperative souk doctor. He moved with mincing steps into a metal-walled room filled with machinery, cables, and preserved body parts in tanks. A mixture of the best Richesian electromechanical technology, souk surgical equipment, and biological specimens from other animals. The smells of lubricants, rot, chemicals, burned flesh, and burning circuits hung heavily in the cold room, even as the station's air recyclers attempted to scrub the contaminants. Several tables contained sinks, metal and plas piping, snaking cables, dispensing machines. Rising above the dissection areas, shimmering hollow blueprints portrayed human limbs as organic machines. As the mentat gazed across the laboratory, Yue's head suddenly appeared on the other side of one of the counters, lean and grease-smeared, with facial bones so prominent they seemed to be made of metal. "Please don't disturb me further, mentat," he said in an abrupt voice, preempting conversation. He didn't even ask how DeVries had found his way back to the restricted Corona moon. The diamond tattoo of Imperial conditioning glistened on his forehead, buried under a smear of dark lubricant from a careless wipe of his hand. "I am very busy." "Still, Doctor, I must speak with you. My Baron commands it." Yue narrowed his eyes, as if imagining how some of his prototype cyborg parts might fit on the mentat. "I am not interested in your Baron's medical condition. It is not my area of expertise." He looked at the laboratory racks and tables filled with experimental prosthetics, as if the answer should be obvious. Yue remained maddeningly aloof, as if he couldn't be touched or corrupted by anything. DeVries approached to within garroting distance of the shorter man, talking all the while. No doubt he would face serious punishment if he was forced to kill this annoying doctor. "My Baron used to be healthy, trim, proud of his physique. Through no change in diet or exercise, he has nearly doubled his body weight in 10 years. He suffers from a gradual deterioration of muscular functions and bloating. Yue frowned, but his gaze turned back to the Mentats. DeVries caught the flicker of expression and lowered his voice, ready to pounce. Do those symptoms sound familiar to you, Doctor? Something you've seen elsewhere? Now Yue became calculating. He shifted so that racks of test apparatus separated him from the twisted Mentat. A long glass tube continued to bubble and stink on the far side of the chamber. No Sukh doctor gives free advice, Mentat. My expenses here are exorbitant, my research vital. DeVries chuckled as his enhanced mind spun through possibilities. And are you so engrossed in your tinkering, Doctor, that you've failed to notice that your patron, House Richese, is nearly bankrupt? Baron Harkonnen's payment could guarantee your funding for many years. The twisted Mentat reached abruptly into his jacket pocket, causing Yue to flinch, fearing a silent weapon. Instead, DeVries brought out a flat, black panel with touchpads. The hollow projection of an old-style sea chest appeared, made entirely of gold with precious gem studs inlaid on its top and sides in the patterns of blue Harkonnen griffins. After you diagnose my baron, you could continue your research however you see fit. Intrigued, Yue reached out, so that his hand and forearm passed through the image. With a synthetic squeal, the lid of the hollow image opened to reveal an empty interior. We will fill this with whatever you please. Melange, Sue Stones, Blue Obsidian, Opafire Jewels, Hagal Quartz, Blackmail Images. Everyone knows that a Sukh doctor can be bought. Then go buy yourself one. Make it a matter of public record. We prefer a more confidential arrangement, as Premier Kalamar promised. The sallow old doctor pursed his dark lips again, deep in thought. Yue's entire world seemed focused on a small bubble around him, as if no one else existed, no one else mattered. I cannot provide long-term care, but I could perhaps diagnose the disease. DeVries shrugged his bony shoulders. The Baron doesn't want you any longer than necessary. Staring at the sheer amount of wealth the Mentat was promising him, Yue imagined how much more productive his work would be here on Corona, given adequate funding. Still, he hesitated. I have other responsibilities. I have been assigned here by the Sukh College for this specific purpose. Cyborg prostheses will be a valuable market for Richese and us, once proven. With a sigh of resignation, DeVries pressed a key on the pad, and the treasure chest became noticeably larger. Yue stroked his mustaches. It might be possible for me to travel between Richese and Gedi Prime, under an assumed identity, of course. I could study your baron, then return here to continue my work. An interesting idea, the Mentat said. So you accept our terms? I agree to examine the patient, and I shall consider what to put in the treasure chest you offer. Yue pointed toward a nearby counter. Now hand me that measuring scope. Since you interrupted, you can help me with constructing a prototype body core. 2 days later on Gedi Prime, adjusting to the industrial air and the heavier gravity, Yue examined the Baron in the infirmary of Harkonnen Keep. All doors closed, all windows covered, all servants sent away. Peter DeVries watched through his peephole, grinning. Yue discarded the medical files the Baron's doctors had compiled over the years, documenting the progress of the disease. Foolish amateurs, I am not interested in them or their test results. Opening his diagnostic kit, the doctor withdrew his own set of scanners, complex mechanisms that only a highly trained Sukh could decipher. Remove your clothing, please. Do you want to play? The Baron tried to retain his dignity, his command of the situation. No. The Baron distracted himself from the uncomfortable probings and proddings as he considered ways to kill this pompous souk if he too failed to discover the cause of the disease. He drummed his fingertips on the examining table. None of my physicians could suggest any effective course of treatment. Given the choice of a clean mind or a clean body, I had to take my pick. Ignoring the basso voice, Yue donned a pair of goggles with green lenses. Suggesting that you strive for both is too much to ask. He initialized the power pack and scanning routines, then peered at the gross, naked form of his patient. The Baron lay on his belly on the examination couch. He muttered constantly, complaining about pains and discomforts. Yue spent several minutes examining the Baron's skin, his internal organs, his orifices, until a string of subtle clues began to fit together in his mind. Finally, the delicate souk scanner detected a vector path. Your condition appears to be sexually generated. Are you able to use this penis? Yue said without the slightest trace of humor. He might have been giving a stock quote. Use it? The Baron gave a rude snort. Hells and damnations, it's still the best part of me. Ironic. Yue used a scalpel to scrape a sample from the foreskin, and the Baron yelped in surprise. I need to run an analysis. The doctor didn't give the slightest hint of an apology. With the slender blade, Yue smeared the fragment of skin onto a thin slide and inserted it into a slot in the front underside of his goggles. Using finger controls, he rotated the specimen in front of his eyes, under varying illuminations. The goggle plas changed color from green to scarlet to lavender. Then he sent the sample through a multi-stage chemical analysis. Was that necessary? The Baron growled. It is only the beginning. Yue then removed more instruments, many of them sharp, from his kit. The Baron would have been intrigued if he'd been able to use the tools on someone else. I must perform many tests. After slipping into a robe, Baron Harkonnen sat back, gray-skinned and sweaty, sore in a thousand places that had not hurt before. Several times he'd wanted to kill this arrogant souk doctor, but he didn't dare interfere with the protracted diagnosis. The other physicians had been helpless and stupid. Now he would endure whatever was necessary in order to obtain his answer. The Baron hoped the treatment and eventual cure would be less aggressive, less painful than Yue's original analysis. He poured from a decanter of Kirana brandy and gulped down a mouthful. I have reduced the spectrum of possibilities, Baron, Yue said, pursing his lips. Your ailment belongs to a category of rare diseases, narrowly defined, specifically targeted. I can collect another full set of samples if you would like me to triple-verify the diagnosis. That will not be necessary. The Baron sat up, gripping his walking stick in case he needed to hit someone with it. What have you found? Yue droned on. The transmission vector is obvious, via heterosexual intercourse. You were infected by one of your female lovers. The Baron's momentary elation at finally finding an answer washed away in confusion. I have no female lovers. Women disgust me. Yes, I see. Yue had heard many patients deny the obvious. The symptoms are so subtly general that I am not surprised less competent doctors missed it. Even souk teaching did not initially include a mention of it. And I learned of such intriguing diseases through my wife, Juana. She is a Bene Gesserit, and the sisterhood occasionally makes use of these disease organisms. The Baron lunged into a sitting position on the edge of the examination couch. A firestorm crossed his jowly face. Those damnable witches! Ah, so now you remember, Yue said with smug satisfaction. When did the contacts occur? Hesitation. Then, more than a dozen years ago. Yue stroked his long mustaches. My Wana tells me that a Bene Gesserit Reverend Mother is capable of altering her internal chemistry to hold diseases latent in her own body. The bitch! The Baron roared. She infected me! The doctor did not seem interested in the injustice or the indignity. More than just passively infected. Such a pathogen is released by force of will. This was not an accident, Baron. In his mind's eye, the Baron envisioned horse-faced Mohiam, the sneering, disrespectful manner with which she had looked at him during the Fenring's banquet. She had known all along, had been watching his body transform itself into this loathsome, corpulent lump. And she had been the cause of it all. Yue closed up his goggles and slipped them back into his diagnostic kit. Our bargain is concluded, and I will take my leave now. I have much research to complete on Richie's. You agreed to treat me. The Baron lost his balance as he tried to surge to his feet. He collapsed back onto the groaning examination couch. I agreed to examine you and no more, Baron. No souk can do anything for your condition. There is no known treatment, no cure, though I am sure we'll eventually study it at the souk college. The Baron clenched his walking stick, finally standing. Seething, he thought about the venom-drenched darts hidden in its tip. But he also understood the political consequences of killing a souk doctor, if word ever got out. The souk school had powerful contacts in the Imperium. It might not be worth the pleasure. Besides, he had murdered enough doctors already. At least he finally had an answer. And a legitimate target for his revenge. He knew who had done this to him. I'm afraid you must ask the Bene Gesserit, Baron. Without another word, Dr. Wellington Yue hurried out of Harkonnen Keep and fled from Giri Prime aboard the next Highliner, glad that he would never have to deal with the Baron again. Some lies are easier to believe than the truth. Orange Catholic Bible. Even surrounded by other villagers, Gurney Halleck felt completely alone. He stared into the watery beer. The brew was weak and sour, though if he drank enough of it, the pain in his body and in his heart grew numb. But in the end, he was left with only a throbbing hangover and no hope of finding his sister. In the 5 months since Captain Kriubi and the Harkonnen Patrol had taken her, Gurney's cracked ribs, bruises, and cuts had healed. Flexible bones, he told himself. A bitter joke. The day after Beth's abduction, he'd been back in the fields, slowly and painfully digging trenches and planting the despised Kral tubers. The other villagers, looking sidelong at him, had continued to work, pretending nothing had happened. They knew that if productivity declined, the Harkonnens would come back and punish them even more. Gurney learned that other daughters had been taken as well, but the parents involved never spoke of it outside their families. Back at the tavern, Gurney rarely sang anymore. Though he carried his old balisette with him, the strings remained silent, and music refused to issue from his lips. He drank his bitter ale and sat sullenly, listening to the tired conversations of his mates. The men repeated complaints about work, about the weather, about uninteresting spouses. Gurney turned a deaf ear on all of it. Though sickened to imagine what Beth might be enduring, he hoped she was still alive. She was probably locked inside a Harkonnen pleasure house, trained to perform unspeakable acts. And if she resisted or failed to meet expectations, she would be killed. As the patrol sweep had proved, Harkonnens could always find other candidates for their stinking brothels. At home, his parents had blocked their own daughter from memory. Without Gurney's painstaking attention, they would have let Beth's garden die. His parents had even performed a mock funeral and recited verses from the battered orange Catholic Bible. For a while, Gurney's mother lit a candle and stared at the flickering flame, her lips moving in a silent prayer. They cut calla lilies and daisies, Beth's favorite flowers, and laid out a bouquet to honor her memory. Then all of it ceased, and they moved on with their dreary lives without mention of her, as if she had never existed. But Gurney never gave up. "Don't you care?" he bellowed one night into his father's seamed face. "How can you let them do this to Beth?" "I didn't let them do anything." The older man seemed to stare right through his son, as if he were made of dirty glass. "There's nothing any of us can do. And if you keep trying to fight against the Harkonnens, they will pay you back in blood." Gurney stormed out to sulk in the tavern, but the villagers there offered no more help. Night after night, he grew disgusted with them. The months passed in a blur. Sloshing his ale, Gurney suddenly sat up at his table and realized what he was becoming. He saw his blunt face in the mirror each morning with a gradual awareness that he had stopped being himself. He, Gurney Halleck, good-natured, full of music and bluster, had tried to reawaken the life in these people. But instead, he'd been transformed into one of them. Though barely in his 20s, he already looked like his aging father. The drone of humorless conversation continued, and Gurney looked at the smooth prefab walls, the streaked window plates. This monotonous routine had not varied for generations. His hand clenched around the flagon, and he took stock of his own talents and abilities. He couldn't fight the Harkonnens with brute strength or weapons, but he had another idea. He could strike back at the Baron and his followers in a more insidious way. Feeling renewed energy, he grinned. "I've got a tune for you, mates, the likes of which you've never heard before." The men smiled uneasily. Gurney held the balisette, strummed its strings as brusquely as if he were peeling coarse vegetables, and sang out in a loud, blustery voice, "We work in the fields, we work in the towns, and this is our lot in life. For the rivers are wide, and the valleys are low, and the Baron, he is fat. We live with no joy, we die without grief, and this is our lot in life. For the mountains are high and the oceans are deep, and the Baron, he is fat. Our sisters are stolen, our sons are crushed, our parents forget, and our neighbors pretend, and this is our lot in life. For our labor is hard and our rest is short, while the Baron grows fat from us." As the stanzas continued, the listener's eyes widened in horror. "Stop this, Halleck," one man said, rising from his seat. "Why, Purd," Gurney said with a sneer, "do you love the Baron so much? I hear he enjoys bringing strong young men like you into his pleasure chambers." Bravely, Gurney sang another insulting song, and another, until finally he felt liberated. These tunes gave him a freedom he'd never before imagined. The onlookers were disturbed and uneasy. Many got up to leave as he continued to sing. But Gurney would not be swayed. He stayed until long after midnight. When finally he walked home that night, Gurney Halleck had a spring in his step. He had struck back at his tormentors, though they would never know it. He wouldn't get enough sleep going to bed at this hour, and work would begin early in the morning. But that didn't bother him. He felt recharged. Gurney returned to the darkened house where his parents had long since retired. He set the balisette in his personal wardrobe, lay back on his pallet, and dozed off with a smile on his lips. Less than 2 weeks later, a silent Harkonnen patrol entered the village of Dimitri. It was 3 hours before dawn. Armed guards battered in the door of the prefab dwelling, though the Hallecks never kept it locked. The uniformed men lit blazing glow globes as they marched in, knocking furniture aside, smashing crockery. They uprooted all the flowers Beth had planted in old pots outside the front door. They tore down the curtains that covered the small windows. Gurney's mother screamed and huddled far back on the bed. His father lurched up, went to the door of their chamber, and saw the troopers. Instead of defending his home, he backed away and slammed the bedroom door, as if that could protect him. But the guards were only interested in Gurney. They dragged the young man from his bed, and he came out flailing wildly with his fists. The men found his resistance amusing, and flung him face down on the fireplace hearth. Gurney chipped a tooth and scraped his chin. He tried to get back to his hands and knees, but two Harkonnens kicked him in the ribs. After ransacking a small closet, one blonde soldier came out with the nicked and patched Balaset. He tossed it on the floor, and Kriubi made sure Gurney's face was turned toward the instrument. As the Harkonnens pressed their victim's cheek against the hearth bricks, the guard captain stomped on the Balaset with a booted foot, breaking its spine. The strings twanged in a discordant jangle. Gurney moaned, feeling a greater pain from that than from the blows he had received. All the work he had put into restoring the instrument, all the pleasure it had given him. "Bastards!" he spat, which earned him another pummeling. He made a concentrated effort to see their faces, recognized a square-featured, brown-haired ditch-digger he'd known from a nearby village, now resplendent in his new uniform with the low-rank insignia of an Immenbrek. He saw another guard with a bulbous nose and a hare lip, a man he was sure had been recruited from Dimitri 5 years before. But their faces showed no recognition, no sympathy. They were the Baron's men now, and would never do anything to risk being sent back to their former lives. Seeing that Gurney recognized them, the guards dragged him outside and beat him with redoubled enthusiasm. During the attack, Kriubi stood tall, sad, and appraising. He ran a finger along his shred of mustache. The guard captain watched in grim silence as his men punched and kicked and beat Gurney, drawing energy from their victim's refusal to cry out as often as they would have liked. They finally stepped back to catch their breath and brought out the sticks. At last, when Gurney could no longer move because his bones were broken, his muscles battered, and his flesh covered with clotting blood, the Harkonnens withdrew. Under the harsh glare of clustered glow globes, he lay bleeding and moaning. Kriubi held up his hand and signaled the men to return to their craft. They took all the glow globes but one, which shed a single flickering light upon the mangled man. Kriubi stared at him with apparent concern, then knelt close by. He spoke quiet words meant only for Gurney. Even through the pain-fogged clamor in his skull, Gurney found it strange. He had expected the Harkonnen guard captain to crow his triumph so that all the villagers could hear. Instead, Kriubi seemed more disappointed than smug. Any other man would have given up long ago. Most men would have been more intelligent. You brought this on yourself, Gurney Halleck. The captain shook his head. Why did you force me to do this? Why did you insist on bringing wrath down upon yourself? I've saved your life this time. Barely. But if you defy the Harkonnens again, we may have to kill you. He shrugged. Or perhaps just kill your family and maim you instead. One of my men has a certain talent for gouging out eyes with his fingers. Gurney tried to speak several times around broken, blood-thick lips. Bastards, he finally managed. Where's my sister? Your sister is not of concern right now. She is gone. Stay here and forget about her. Do your work. We each have our job to do for the Baron, and if you fail in yours... Kriubi's nostrils flared. Then I must do mine. If you speak out against the Baron, if you insult him, if you ridicule him to incite discontent, I will have to act. You're smart enough to know that. With an angry grunt, Gurney shook his head. Only his anger sustained him. Every drop of his blood that spattered the ground he swore to repay with Harkonnen blood. With his dying breath he would discover what had happened to his sister. And if by some miracle Beth remained alive, he would rescue her. Kriubi turned toward the troop transport, where the guards had already seated themselves. Don't make me come back. He looked over his shoulder at Gurney and added a very odd word. Please. Gurney lay still, wondering how long it would take for his parents to venture out and see whether he lived or not. He watched through blurred vision and pain-smeared eyes as the transport lifted off and left the village. He wondered if any other lights would come on, if any villagers would come out and help him, now that the Harkonnens were gone. But the dwellings in Dimitri remained dark. Everyone pretended not to have seen or heard. The strictest limits are self-imposed. Fridra Ginaz, Philosophy of the Swordmaster. When Duncan Idaho arrived at Ginaz, he believed he needed nothing more than the old Duke's prized sword to become a great warrior. His head full of romantic expectations, he envisioned the swashbuckling life he would lead, the marvelous fighting techniques he would learn. He was only 20 and looked forward to a golden future. Reality was quite different. The Ginaz school was an archipelago of habitable islands scattered like breadcrumbs across turquoise water. On each island, different masters taught students their particular techniques that ranged from shield fighting, military tactics, and combat skills to politics and philosophy. Over the course of his 8-year training ordeal, Duncan would move from one environment to the next and learn from the best fighters in the Imperium. If he survived... The school's main island served as the spaceport and administration center, surrounded by reefs that blocked waves from the choppy water. Tall, clustered buildings reminded Duncan of the bristles of a spiny rat, like the one he'd kept as a pet inside the Harkonnen prison fortress. Revered throughout the Imperium, the swordmasters of Ginaz had built many of their primary structures as museums and memorials, rather than classrooms. This reflected the supreme confidence they felt in their personal fighting abilities, a self-assurance that bordered on hubris. Politically neutral, they served their art and allowed its practitioners to make their own choices regarding the Imperium. Contributing to the mythology, the Academy's graduates had included the leaders of many great houses in the Landsraad. Master jongleurs were commissioned to compose songs and commentary about the great deeds of the legendary heroes of Ginaz. The central skyscraper, where Duncan would endure his final testing years hence, held the tomb of Jules Noret, founder of the Ginaz school. Noret's sarcophagus lay in open view, surrounded by clear armor plaques and a Holtzman-generated shield. Yet only the worthy were allowed to see it. Duncan vowed that he would prove himself worthy. He was met at the spaceport by a slender, bald woman wearing a black martial arts gi. Brisk and businesslike, she introduced herself as Karsti Toper. "I have been assigned to take your possessions." She extended her hand for his rucksack and the long bundle containing the old Duke's sword. He clutched the blade protectively. "If you give me your personal guarantee that these items will be safe..." Her forehead furrowed, wrinkling her shaved head. "We value honor more than any other house in the Landsraad." Her hand remained extended, unwavering. "Not more than the Atreides," Duncan said, still refusing to relinquish the blade. Karsty Topper frowned as she considered. Not more, perhaps, but we are comparable. Duncan handed her the packages, and she directed him to a long-distance shuttle thopter. Go there. You will be taken to your first island. Do what you are told without complaining and learn from everything. She tucked the sword bundle and his rucksack under her arms. We will hold these for you until it is time. Without seeing the Ganaz city or the school administration tower, Duncan was flown far across the deep sea to a low, lush island like a lily pad that barely lifted itself out of the water. Jungles were dense and huts were few. The three uniformed crewmen dropped him on the beach and departed without answering any of his questions. Duncan stood all alone, listening to the rush of ocean against the island shore, reminded of Caladan. He had to believe this was some sort of test. A deeply tanned man with frizzy white hair and thin, sinewy limbs strode out to meet him, parting palm fronds. He wore a sleeveless black tunic belted at the waist. The man's expression appeared stony as he squinted into the light glaring off the beach. I am Duncan Idaho. Are you my first instructor, sir? Instructor? The man scowled. Yes, Rat, and my name is Jamo Reed. But prisoners don't use names here because everyone knows his place. Do your work and don't cause any trouble. If the others can't keep you in line, then I will. Prisoners? I'm sorry, Master Reed, but I'm here for swordmaster training. Reed laughed. Swordmaster? That's rich! Without giving him any time to settle, the man assigned Duncan to a rugged work crew with dark-skinned Ginaz natives. Duncan communicated by rough hand signals, since none of the natives spoke Imperial Gaelic. For several hot and sweaty days, the men dug channels and wells to improve the water system for an inland village. The air was so thick with humidity and biting gnats that Duncan could barely breathe. As evening approached and the gnats dissipated, the jungle swarmed with mosquitoes and black flies, and Duncan's skin was covered with swollen bites. He had to drink copious amounts of water just to replace what he sweated out. As Duncan labored to move heavy stones by hand, the sun warmed the rippling muscles of his bare back. Workmaster Reed watched from the shade of a mango tree, arms folded across his chest, a studded whip gripped in one hand. He never said a word about swordmaster training. Duncan voiced no complaints, demanded no answers. He had expected Ginaz to be unexpected. This has to be some kind of test. Before attaining his 9th birthday, he'd suffered cruel tortures at the hands of the Harkonnens. He had watched Glossu Raban murder his parents. Even as a boy, he had killed hunters in Forest Guard Preserve. And he'd finally escaped to Caladan, only to see his mentor, Duke Paulus Atreides, slain in the bullring. Now, after a decade of service to House Atreides, he chose to view each day's effort as a training exercise, toughening himself for future battles. He would become a swordmaster of Ginaz. A month later, another thopter unceremoniously dropped off a red-haired, pale-skinned young man. The newcomer looked out of place on the beach, upset and confused, just as Duncan must have appeared at his own arrival. Before anyone could speak to the redhead, though, Master Reed sent the work crews to hack at the dense undergrowth with dull machetes. The jungle seemed to grow back as fast as they could cut it down. Perhaps that was the point of sending convicts here, a perpetual but pointless errand, like the myth of Sisyphus he'd heard during his studies with the Atreides. Duncan didn't see the redhead again until two nights later, when he tried to fall asleep in his own primitive palm frond hut. In a shelter on the other side of the shoreline encampment, the newcomer lay moaning with a horrible sunburn. Duncan crept out to help him under the starlight of Ginaz, rubbing a creamy salve on the worst blisters, as he had seen the natives do. The redhead hissed at the pain, bit back an outcry. He finally spoke in Gaelic, startling Duncan.
Thank you, whoever you are.
Then he lay back and closed his eyes. Damn poor way to run a school, wouldn't you say? What am I doing here? The young man, he Resser, came from one of the houses minor on Grumman. As part of a family tradition, every other generation selected a candidate to be trained on Ginaz. But during his generation, he was the only one available. I was considered a poor choice, a cruel joke to send here, and my father is convinced I'm going to fail. Resser winced as he sat up, feeling his raw, blistered skin. Everyone tends to underestimate me. Neither of them knew how to explain his situation, stuck on an island populated by convicts. It'll toughen us up at least, Duncan said. The next day, when Jamo Reed saw them talking with each other, he scratched his frizzy white hair, scowled, then assigned them to different work details on opposite sides of the island. Duncan did not see Resser again for quite a while. As months passed with no further information, no structured exercises, Duncan began to grow angry, resenting the wasted time when he could have been serving House Atreides. How was he ever going to become a swordmaster at this rate? One dawn, as he lay in his hut, instead of the expected call from Workmaster Reed, Duncan heard a rhythmic beating of thopter wings, and his heart leaped. Racing outside, he saw a craft landing on the wide, wet beach just within the line of breakers. Wind from the articulated wings blew the leaf fronds like fans. A slender, bald form in a black gi climbed out and spoke with Jamo Reed. The sinewy workmaster grinned and extended a warm handshake. Duncan had never noticed that Reed's teeth were so white. Karsty Toper stepped aside, letting her eyes rove across the curious prisoners who had emerged from their huts. Workmaster Reed turned back to the convicts standing beside their ramshackle huts.
Duncan Idaho! Come over here, rat!
Duncan ran across the rocky beach toward the thopter. When he got closer to the flying machine, he could see red-headed Hee Resser already sitting inside the cockpit. He pressed a freckled, smiling face against the curved window plaz. The woman bowed her shaved head to him, then ran her eyes up and down his body like a scanner. She turned to Reed and spoke in Gaelic. Success, Master Reed? The workmaster shrugged his whipcord shoulders, and his moist eyes suddenly filled with expression.